Coming up next on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
This is 94.7 WPVC Resistance Radio, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence coming to you from New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts. We guarantee every show will be apropos of something. We are very grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams Realty. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Carmenita Higginbotham, professor of American art at the University of Virginia. She's a Depression-era scholar with expertise in the visual culture of Hollywood and Disney and African-American identity in art. And we have Lori Jean, who works for SARA, the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. She works closely with the community and with adolescents to end sexual violence. We'll discuss her work using a positive sexuality framework and why that's important for the next generation. But first, Nancy, are you here?
Ellen, I am here after a week of not being here, but I must say, if I may, doesn't it feel like it's been longer? I just, it does feel that way.
Yeah, it does feel that way. A lot has happened in the world since we last spoke.
No. Can't think of anything. I was going to just talk about the weather this morning, which I could talk about, but yes, I realize we're all on like Sally Yates watch and James Comey watch. Someone's going to hand them a bottle of water with polonium in it or something.
What is that? Polonium?
That's that thing, that that chemical poison that Putin is famous for. It's his go-to poison for that one that one Russian guy who has survived twice. But anyway,
wow.
it's a killer in theory. So
their DNA is starting to get used to it and adapt probably over there. I was going to get right into it about BLOTUS meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov the day after Comey's firing, and that the White House, just a few points that just I cannot believe. The White House spokesman said, you know, why did he meet with them? He chose to receive him because Putin asked him to.
Yeah. He's a tough guy, our president. Anyway, I'm sorry, you were saying.
No, I mean, do you get the idea that that meeting with Lavrov was like a performance review or a strategy meeting? Like, how am I doing?
I'm on the side of there were bugs planted everywhere, you know, in the Oval Office. I don't put anything past those guys. And Trump is, as you know, I mean, he's all in it for the compliments. So, so he's willing to, you know, turn that Andrew Jackson painting into, you know, poke the eyes out of the back of it, put a Russian diplomat in there or something. I don't know. You know, he'll do anything for a compliment from those guys because he's in with all that real estate, which he said, I'm sure you did. You saw that quote of his about, I have no business dealings in Russia with a few exceptions.
Right. That's now a hashtag. Also, it's something that struck me is he said that one of the reasons for Comey's firing, other than the ridiculous Hillary email thing, is he doesn't have the confidence of the FBI anymore. He can't lead. And I was thinking, he projects everything.
Right.
So who doesn't have the confidence of the people and who cannot lead? It's himself. He's projector. That's my new name for him, projector of the United States.
Fine with me. you don't have to... he can still be a POTUS, the peace
right.
days.
And if you look at the acronym.
And the peace days, because he's, you know, he's a fan of peace, so it all works. But
right.
I truly don't understand why the media and whomever, why do they keep taking this guy seriously? They want to parse everything like it means something. He's a serial liar, you know, it's just, from one day to the next, anyway.
Yes. Okay. Well, speaking of the opposite of that, if I may segue that way and say, speaking truth to power, I wanted to move on with our lovely show today. It's amazing. And I wanted to mention an event going on in town here, for those of you in Charlottesville. The Lin-Manuel Miranda play In the Heights is being performed here in Charlottesville by Monticello High School by donation only to benefit Sin Barreras, who was a guest, Edgar Laras was a guest here on this very show, and Creciendo Juntos. Today that play is at 2 p.m., and those are both Sin Barreras, Creciendo Juntos, are nonprofit orgs here supporting Latino families in Charlottesville and surrounding communities through education, advocacy, and direct services. So today at 2, go out and see that play.
Yeah, it reminds me of the one of our, I don't think it's our introduction anymore, but, you know, somebody, while we still can, like talking about things while we still can, you know, the fact that that play is going on, it's like, while that stuff is still available to see, I'm on such a autocratic alert, you know, at any minute, that, you know, we're just not going to, all of it is going to be shut down for our, what do you call him? Our projector in chief to run it with an iron fist. Anyway, you were saying.
Well, just on a lighter note, you know, I always like to be the light to your
lighter note
to your whatever. It's the New York Times called this play. Of course, it was on the Broadway version of the play, but it was a really nice review. It said it's a singing mural of Latin American life that often has the inspiriting flavor of a morning pick me up on a warm summer day. Light and sweet are actually just the words to describe this amiable show, which boasts an infectious, bouncy Latin pop score by a gifted young composer, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Goodness, you know what? You guys, your town, and this is going to sound, well, I hope it does. I genuinely mean it. You guys do everything down there. I've learned so much about what goes on thanks to you, and it's always five star or whatever the stars are these days. I don't know.
Coming from New York City, that's great. And we'd love to have you in the studio, Nancy, sometime.
Yeah, I would like to be there right now. It is 51. Once again, I have taken my scarf off the high shelf, thinking I'm done with it. It's back down where I can reach it for today. It's freezing out, is my point, and raining.
Well, there. We do have an amazing show, so back to the weather. I mean, you know, we'll do the weather later. But our first guest is Lori Jean. Yeah. Lori Jean, she works for SARA, the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. She has spent the past 9 years working closely with the community and with adolescents to end sexual violence. She began her career working with survivors of trafficking, sexual assault, and harassment. These experiences guide her work as an abuse preventionist. She's developed sexual violence prevention programs in 3 Virginia counties, basing her work on research on perpetrators, bystanders, public health, marketing, and psychology. Welcome, Lori Jean.
Hi.
I don't think I heard you well. Will you speak up?
Thank you, both of you.
Yes, I do. How are you doing, Ellen? Do you hear her? Is that all right?
I can hear her very well.
Okay.
You can hear her? Okay.
I can.
All right, good. Well, Lori Jean, so can you talk to us about the need, just a little bit about the need, or I don't know if you have any stats right off the bat, but the need for this kind of prevention work, sexual violence prevention.
Yeah, and just to clarify, is my mic on? Okay. Just to clarify, you know, I work for a local nonprofit. I'm not here representing.
I think you should switch mics. Sorry. Say something into that mic. Let me hear you.
Yeah, because, you know, Trump may be taping all of this, and we want to make
sorry,
sure.
Sorry, everybody. Oh, yep.
Yes, I'm thrilled that mic is working.
Yeah, so sorry.
So let's start over, because no one got to hear your words. Just the basis for the need for this kind of work to begin with.
So I do work for a local nonprofit. That is kind of where I think I gain a lot of my expertise is from my work over the years, but I'm not here representing them. As someone for whom this is really my life passion, the need for prevention work... I mean, I hope that at this point it goes without saying. I think at this point we know that the numbers are 1 in 4, 1 in 5, you know, men and women. And, you know, I think we know at this point that sexual assault is a national issue. I think the question of is rape a negative thing is not really a question for anyone. And hopefully we've moved beyond the idea that this is like a special interest issue. This is something that impacts everybody. And even if even if you don't know who the people are in your life who have been survivors of sexual assault, at this point, you live in a community where there are hundreds of survivors, even in a small community like ours. So just by that notion, we are all sort of dealing. And when I talk about prevention, what we're talking about is cultural change. And honestly, I don't even, you know, prevention of sexual assault and talking about the problem and all that is one thing. To me, that is kind of, we don't really, that's not where we need to be going. What we need to be doing is looking at what is healthy sexuality. Where do we want to be? What would a good community, a healthy, safe community look like? What would it look like if we took responsibility for each other and protected each other instead of sort of just saying, oh, we have this problem. There's nothing we can do about it. Victims should watch out for themselves, mm-hmm. Which has not worked. Mm-hmm. has done nothing to help us over the past 40 plus years.
Yeah.
Well, I know that you're an advocate of teaching sexuality at, you know, certain ages with certain English, but what are some of your recommendations to how should we talk to our kids about it as opposed to teens?
Yeah.
What are your recommendations on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the key is, first of all, I want to define sexuality when I talk about healthy sexuality. I think people tend to assume I'm talking about sexual intercourse or I'm talking about sexual identity. Sure, those are part of it. Sexuality, though, is just part of who we are as human beings. It's built into our bodies, both through our genitalia. God, I hate that word, but you guys know what I mean. Through our genitalia but not even just that, through our neurons, right? Through our synapses. It's part of who we are, that we are sexual beings. And I work with a lot of, parents. I'm friends with a lot of people who are parents of children of various ages. And my biggest concern, honestly, at the moment is this sort of reaction I get from parents when I say, hey, what have you been talking to your kids about? Like, has this been a topic? What types of things do you talk about with sexuality? And I often get a reaction from parents of like, oh gosh, like I can't talk about that. I don't want to think about it. It's terrifying to me. Particularly parents of girls are like, oh God, I want to pretend like they never will. And I, you know, still sometimes get the whole boys will be boys things from parents of boys. And we see this in the national data too. Parents are not having the conversations that we need them to have with their kids. And so my biggest hope is that parents will release whatever age your children are, whatever gender, whatever identity, that parents will stop and really think about, okay, what is it that's holding me back? What are my internal sort of psychological, experiential issues that face me that make me feel uncomfortable about sexuality, or that make me feel like this isn't something that I even want to think about my kid ever doing? Because my hope is that for as many parents as I can reach, that mindset would shift from sort of wanting to be in denial that your child will ever do this to understanding that from day one, their sexuality, meaning their emotions, their thoughts, their feelings, all related to intimacy and reproduction and relationship and family, all of the things that play into sexuality and relationships over the years, start from day one. And so I want parents to really be thinking about, okay, what would it look like to, like, what am I excited for my kid about? You know, that someday they will have relationships that most likely, you know, there are some asexual people, but for most kids, someday they're going to hopefully have relationships where they're engaging in more sexual, certainly feelings and behaviors at some point. And that should be something that we're excited for them about. Sexuality is supposed to be something good and beautiful, that is really a part of our lives that allows us to flourish and to connect in really special ways. And so to really, as parents, introspectively think about, well, what would healthy sexuality look like in my life if I haven't had it? What is my vision for what I want my child to have? And really, if as you're thinking about that, if some of the cliches like, oh, I just want them to wait until they find someone that loves them or whatever, that's a good thing. But if that comes to mind as sort of a cliche like that, to really sit and think about what does that really mean? Because as we're educating kids, as we all know, it's giving them the components, right? We can't give them the cliches or the broad summaries. We need to sort of build up that framework for them, because we want to give them that vision too for themselves and for their partners, and to see sexuality as both something that they have agency in, that can be beautiful when they're old enough and when it is appropriate and healthy and good, and that is a relational thing.
So have
It's okay. So what are the common barriers that you find in terms of the adolescents, middle school, that age that you need to break down or talk to them about?
Are you talking about like for gender, me as an educator, or for parents?
For you, but in other words, what are the issues that sometimes stand in the way of boys and girls from treating each other respectfully, or perhaps, you know, getting into gender identity and stereotypes?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole topic unto itself. How is that connected to the previous?
Well,
are you thinking about what should parents be thinking about to prepare them?
Sure.
Is that
sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that we are as a society having the conversation about right now. I think this next generation is really fascinating. They are, if you guys have seen, Time even covered it, National Geographic, and I'm definitely seeing it in person with our students. They're kind of like moving towards a post-gender society. So I think we as adults kind of need to like sit back and check ourselves and think about, you know, can we meet them where they are and in what they're experiencing? And again, you know, remembering that the sex is different from gender, right? I'm not talking about sexuality here. I'm talking about sex as far as like identity, right? So that's your body, your biological, like how you are born, which also can change. But also then gender is about your cultural sort of expression and your personal identity. I think as far as for us as adults to be willing to sort of evaluate what assumptions we're coming to the table with, and really listen well. I mean, I guess if I work with teens and preteens mostly, so I guess I would speak to, you know, if you have a child who is that age, to really at that age, you can really be asking questions, right? Isn't this so much about asking questions, both education and parenting, and trying to understand them and sort of where they're coming from. That certainly is part of these conversations around sexuality.
And when you speak with teens, do you hear some common questions? Are you hearing the same thing over and over, or what are you hearing, I guess, is my question to you?
Well, I work with kids who, I mean, Charlottesville is a small town, but I work with kids who live in the city, and I work with kids who live way, 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 way out in the country. So I hear the gamut. I come in and I'm talking to them about sexuality and relationships, you know, in the context of usually family life and other spaces, counseling spaces, group spaces. I think what I find mostly is that boys in particular in our society have not been given spaces to really explore these ideas. It's funny because I think everyone, just because of the past, you know, 30 to 40 years, the focus has really been on girls and all the disadvantages that our society has set them up with. And those are still, many of those are still there, and we're dealing with them. But I think we've done a lot to start to address it and to start to work towards empowering them. And I think in the process, we've totally failed to realize that the problem with gender is not a female problem, right? It's a society-wide problem. And when it comes to, honestly, I think we're acting on our stereotypes that, you know, boys are already hypersexual and already, you know, and don't need us to sort of have these conversations, and that they don't care about talking about relationships. I mean, that is bogus. It's 100% a stereotype. I come into these rooms of like 7th and 8th grade and 9th grade boys, and they are craving a space where they can safely, honestly ask questions about relationships and sexuality. I mean, they're just really craving it.
So we have a hard break we're going to go to, and I want to thank you. We're going to have you back because that was not long enough.
Okay.
If you had like really 10 seconds to say what you wanted people to take away, what would it be?
Well, there's a lot of other topics I'd be happy to talk about, but today's topic of just, you know, thinking about our sort of next generation and sexuality. The last thing I would say is just don't leave out consent. And the way to talk about consent with boys, girls, anyone, any gender identity, is that it's about the initiator. It's the person who's thinking about, oh, I want to do something sexual with my partner. It's on them to find out first. And the way that we teach it to our eighth graders, everybody that we work with all of the eighth graders basically in the region, is just we teach that consent is a free, happy, clear yes and nothing less. And obviously we take the time to get into what that means and do a lot of activities around it, but stick to that it's freely given. It's happy because sex is supposed to be a good thing. So if they're not happy, you got to wonder. And clear, like I need to be clear of where they are, whether they actually are consenting or not. And I'm not going to push them into that, but I want to make sure I know before I initiate anything.
Thank you so much, Lori Jean.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yes, who works closely with the community to prevent sexual violence. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Carmenita Higginbotham, professor of American art. We'll be right back. You're listening to Apropos of Something, airing every Saturday from 10 to 11 and 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Nancy, are you still with us?
I am, Ellen.
We're grateful for, I'll let you say it. We're grateful for the sponsorship of the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Just wanted to sneak that in there.
Please. May I give a news of note at
sure.
this moment, or is this okay?
Sure.
My news is more like a disaster, but nonetheless, mine is about Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. I have a twofer on Tom today, in that he said something, which was a lie, that the $880 billion cut to Medicaid with the new health care plan will not result in millions losing their coverage. And then that he also said nothing in a state nearby you in West Virginia when that West Virginia reporter was arrested for doing his job for asking Tom Price a question in the hall. Did you hear about that? He was arrested for...
Oh, yes, I did.
For speaking loudly in a hallway.
Yeah.
Spent 8 hours in jail for being part of the fake news. Anyway, just troubling that
it's
this is happening.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what do you got?
Yeah. You know, it's just... throw a dart. What to be upset about? But I wanted to bring to light the executive order just signed, Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, which I just need to read what Ari Berman, who writes for The Nation, wrote. He covers voting rights. He said, "This is not an election integrity commission. It's a voter suppression commission because there's no evidence of widespread voter fraud to investigate. Everyone who's looked into it, including Trump's own lawyers during the recounts in Michigan and other states, has said that the election was not tainted by fraud. So the only reason to do this and the only reason to announce it this week, other than to soothe Trump's ego, other than to distract from the news about Comey and Russia, is to perpetuate the myth of voter fraud in order to lay the groundwork for policies that will suppress the vote, to provide ammunition for Republicans, basically, at the state and federal level to suppress the votes of Democrats." And it's a great piece in The Nation or Democracy Now. You can see it. Just all the data supporting that, you know, what he's saying. It's not an issue. There's so much more to say. And that the Kansas Secretary of State, Kris Kobach, was put in. He is just a piece of work. I mean, he lobbied to get to become the only person in this country who's allowed to prosecute election crimes. It's horrible.
Yeah, I mean, just when it's like, as they say, you know, don't keep your eyes on keep your eyes on everything, because it's not just, you know, the blowhard in the Oval Office. I mean, these Republicans have been doing stuff like voter suppression for years now, and it's more like they're just not ashamed of it. You know, now they're just doing it out in front of us, which is not funny. It's all very scary, and... that is actually, of course, the most concerning, that they're all, you know, as much as they've been gerrymandering for years now, there's the vote, you know, will Democrats, anyone registered as a Democrat count? You know, what are they doing behind the scenes to make sure that doesn't happen, regardless of whether Trump stays or not, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's move on to art.
Let's talk about art.
Let's talk about
art. Come on.
Our next honored guest is Dr. Carmenita Higginbotham. She's the professor of American art at the University of Virginia. Her expertise is wide-reaching and fascinating. She's a Depression-era scholar, also studying the visual culture of Hollywood and Disney and African-American identity in art. Her book, The Urban Scene, Race, Reginald Marsh, and American Art, Penn State University Press, looks at the ways in which race is deployed and read in interwar American art. Wow. Welcome, Carmenita.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes. So let's talk about a few of those topics. I wanted to start with the Whitney Biennial controversy.
Right. The huge controversy, a pretty exciting event that happened. So at the major exhibition that's held at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, there various artists are invited to include work, and there was a piece that has really caused an uproar. It's a work by an artist named Dana Schutz, and it is basically a work that is imagining or representing the representation of Emmett Till. This would be the young African American in 1955 who is murdered by a mob and whose funeral is publicized both in Jet Magazine and by the Chicago Defender and Chicago Publications. And it's known for, the incident is known for the famous representations of the pictures that were taken and then reproduced in various publications. So this artist has gone and made a painting in reference to those photographs, and it's caused quite an uproar.
And that was 1955 or so when that event, the murder occurred.
That's when that event occurred.
Okay.
And so with this uproar, with this issue that's going on, a number of artists have proclaimed that this sort of representation shouldn't exist. And it has led to protests right in front of the work, as folks stand in front of it while visitors are trying to move through and see the piece. And it's really sort of consumed a set of conversations about race and art in the 21st century.
What was your feeling about the controversy, actually? I was curious what you thought about it.
Well, I think it's something that's quite justified in a way. You can understand in this heightened racial and political climate why that type of image would cause a reaction. At the same time, I'm an art historian. I believe in art. I believe in the production of art. I believe everyone has the right to produce art and have that art be seen. And so I think that one can understand the social terrain on which all of this is happening, where everybody's very anxious, where young black youths are getting shot, where violence seems to be a regular occurrence happening to African Americans and other groups as well. But at the same time, this is a healthy expression of one's sort of personal take on a previous representation, and I don't think that should ever be blocked or stopped.
I'm with you on the second part. I mean, there is always time to be outraged when, you know, when there's something to be outraged about, but I read that story and I saw the artwork and I just didn't, I mean, I understand it intellectually, but I thought it was the negative to the fact they want to close it down and all of this. I get it, but I didn't, I'm not in favor of it.
I'm not
that.
At
it just
all.
Doesn't seem what art is about. It just really bothered me.
Well,
actually,
to be the devil's advocate, what do you think about white artists profiting from, you know, harm or,
but she's not.
But she's not. And well, that was one of the arguments that she
She could be themed as profiting, you know, she's getting a lot of press. She's getting a lot of,
well, that's because people are standing in front of it, not only are seeing it. Right?
Well, I think that the controversy around it has probably sparked an increased amount of attention on the work that may not be there. It is a perfectly all right work. This is an artist who knows paint, who understands surface and color aesthetically. It's an interesting piece, but it is not a show-stopping piece. It is not a particularly large work. It is really the reaction to the painting that has really caused more attention to be paid to it. So I think it had the unintended effect, I think, what some of the protesters were doing by drawing attention to it. But I don't think that's what that work is doing. It's almost an abstracted representation, which means you can't really tell facial features, excuse me. You can't really locate what's sort of happening right. based on the choices that the artist has made. It seems like sort of an empty and hollow argument to say that this is a capitalization on black pain when it raises a question: shouldn't everybody get to represent, or who gets to own representation? Does that mean only black people can represent black people and only white people can represent white people? It really speaks to an inequity of representation.
I'm with you.
Yeah, I can totally see that. I mean, I think it's maybe a slippery slope for, I don't know. There's a lot of the whole white guilt thing, I think, comes up in terms of, well, when you see that, you're like, well, should I be the representer of that? I mean, I totally see what you're saying, but I think some people might take the other side and say, you know, is that really radical? Is it a radical statement? It's not that radical, really.
Well, whether the art is a radical statement, definitely the protest has become, you know, a source of controversy that is even splitting and splitting the art communities about how they should respond to that kind of representation. I think it really just speaks to how much we as a culture are very much invested in imagery and images of violence, and how we are sensitive to where and how the media has access and can promote certain representations. And when an artist steps in and reimagines something, are they culpable? Are they a part of the original debate? Have they entered into new terrain? I think it's pretty powerful to go back to the violence and the lynching of Emmett Till, being an African-American male. But how many people actually in the public know that story is another issue.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
This isn't a Martin Luther King Jr. representation. This isn't a Malcolm X. Right. This is something quite different.
Mm-hmm. And I know. Actually, I'm glad you're here for two segments because we both have other questions to ask you. But I was just curious too. I mean, I know you read more on this than I have. That in her rationale, her inspiration, whatever, for painting this was more mother-child loss. That, you know, everyone brought this baggage to it. That's how I see it. She wasn't doing it for. I even read, I think, somewhat, you know, for fun and profit. You know, it was not why she painted it.
I think that is a valid conversation. I think also, though, one, she has to be not responsible but attentive to the fact that it is a representation or an image that is born from a racial incident. So there is this issue of, yes, it's what is it like to be a mother and have that kind of violence? But you could ask the question, how many white mothers are worried about their kids headed out at night in hoodies? How many white mothers are thinking about, will their children be lynched? Or do they have a history of lynching in their own backgrounds that they have, you know, sort of always sort of swirling as sort of a soundtrack behind you as you are a mother. So there are, not to argue both sides as a scholar, but there is that other component. There is a racial conversation going on. And I think Schutz knew she was getting involved in that, but that wasn't her target. That wasn't her main issue. And I think there is a genuineness to her saying it's about being a mother. But there is the racial component she can't totally be absolved from.
Sure, and that's the, you know, the wonder and the beauty of art. Someone else is free to paint that same idea in their way, and, you know, we can look at it hopefully in a museum and think about it from their point of view. And, no one has to be right. I know we're not exactly arguing with each other. I'm just saying out into the atmosphere. No one has to be right on this or more right. It's just...
Mm-hmm.
yeah, I think bothering
that,
me.
That is the beauty of art. I think that's a really good point, because it raises discussion and it points to the hurt and the pain in the African American community is what it's talking to. It doesn't. So I guess my opinion would be you don't take it out on that art.
Right.
You have the conversation.
Right.
It instigates conversation, which is what we need. We need spaces to have pretty honest dialogues about these types of things. And if art can do that, that's amazing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. Now I want to ask you a question about something you know specifically about, because you wrote a book on it. So,
okay.
So, so I'm going to get off the other. I was wondering why you wrote that. The book, The Urban Scene, Race, Reginald Marsh, and American Art, and who is and was really Reginald Marsh? What prompted you to write that book?
Well, Reginald Marsh is an artist, was an artist, who worked in the 1930s. He was quite a prominent, well-trained individual, came from the Wright families, and he spent a lot of his time, by Wright families, I mean, he studied at Yale. His one of his roommates and best friends was Henry Luce, who ended up founding Time Magazine and Life Magazine. He knew folks who would go on to be senators. He went to private schools and what have you. He became an artist, and he spent a lot of time in the city. And in the 1930s, he begins to produce a whole bevy of work that include black bodies. And he will stop by 1938. And it's a very interesting sort of pocket of time between 1928 and 1938. And so I became very fascinated by why this I'd like to call him a non-black artist. He's a white artist. Painting certain bodies at this time period when the country, and particularly New York, is in such an upheaval, when you have a contest not just of class and gender but also race happening at the same time, and why often he doesn't even picture that. His are very celebratory urban images. And so I became very fascinated about race as a language. What happens when an artist decides to include racial bodies, and those bodies are doing a kind of cultural work beyond making claims about the political affiliations of the artist? So that when you have an artist representing a black body, you're not engaged in the conversation of, oh, he must have known black people, or he liked black people. But rather, these are choices that artists are making that are making comments about the way they understand space and the city and the interaction between people and pleasure and spectacle and all of these other components. And there weren't a lot of scholars doing that kind of investigation on white male artists. So it was a very interesting, long endeavor. but it was an exciting project to take on.
So you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville and Resistance Radio. We're going to go to a break, and we'll continue talking with Dr. Carmenita Higginbotham, professor of American art at the University of Virginia. Welcome back to Apropos of Something with Ellen Daniels. That's me and Nancy Lawrence in New York City. We're talking with Dr. Carmen Higginbotham, professor of American art at UVA. Welcome back, everybody.
Professor.
Yeah.
I was just wondering about, you know, picking up on the book that you wrote on this artist. How does art in your view frame this debate on race?
Well, I hope I answer your question. I think within the context of my book, I think art has always been invested in the power of race, the ways in which race, as it's been visualized, speaks to who controls culture and society, the economics, the psychology of it, who has access to it, who can benefit from it in the future. And even as we look at works that have figures or bodies in them that point to or gesture to things that they are doing, those bodies are always coded racially. And when we look at them, whether it's in the 16th century or the 21st century, we bring our own understandings of social structures around race to those works. We formulate our own opinions. I think it's pivotal, it's critical to looking at any image, even if it is full of just white bodies.
So, go ahead. I just wanted to get to Disney. I want to get to Disney. So what is the visual impact, do you think, of Disney on our culture?
That's a pivot.
Yeah. Sorry, you know, in the world of radio.
That's what you have to do. The other part of my life is I spend quite a bit of time studying and working on Disney, which feels like a hard pivot most days. The critical impact of Disney. I like it. It's interesting for the same reasons that I like to study race at times. I like it because it's something that's so obvious. It's so pervasive. And it's something we don't notice, but is changing who we are and what we think about. And those are the things I like to study. And that's why Disney fits in. No, Disney is everywhere. Disney explains to children, to adults, what family is, what love is, what it looks like, the things that we should strive for, who we should be, what heroism is. Mm-hmm. It tells us all these things, and it's never really criticized. We don't question it. We park our kids in front of it. We go to the movies with it, with Disney and the corporation, and we let it teach us. And at no point do we stop and critically reflect on what it is we're learning.
So what are
we learning?
Do you
know why we're so obsessed with it?
I'm so sorry, what?
Do you know why we're so obsessed with Disney?
In many respects, it feeds into, at least this country, our sense of the American dream, this idea that this myth that we can achieve whatever it is we want if we dream hard enough, if we wish hard enough, and if we work hard enough, and that one can ascend. And that's a space that Disney, from the very beginning, when Walt got started in his corporation, that's what's been sort of pushed and fed through a majority of the films. And I think that, and the films are the primary vehicles for Disney. And then as the company has grown in the late 20th century to theme parks and stage shows on Broadway and cruise ships, it becomes the marker of everything we expect. How many folks do you know say, I need to take the kids to Disneyland or Disney World as their marker of middle class achievement?
Yes.
Everybody. What do you think Disney would think of the way his empire has become a place where there's land and world with his name on it? What do you think what would his impression be?
I think he would be speaking for a dead white man.
I think
he would be pleased if it made people quote unquote happy. Now, this is certain people get to be happy, and a certain kind of happy, a heteronormative kind of happiness. But I think that as long as that happiness feeds into sort of a patriotic vision, then he would be all right with it. Walt himself moved in and out of his relationship to the company as a company. He didn't like the business side of it. He didn't like thinking about the ways in which it could expand. He liked affecting audiences. And that's something we should all be really conscious of when we go watch a Disney film, whether it's the new live action Beauty and the Beast, not my favorite narrative, but that, which I did go see, whether that or Moana, the more recent offering, or the way the company's grown into everything from Star Wars and Marvel films. It owns ABC. I mean, it's everywhere. It's, you know, connected to everything.
Can you talk about, you said before, you know, my question was, what are we learning? And you touched on it. What do you think we are learning from this widespread media empire?
I think we're learning a lot of pernicious ideas about gender and gender roles. I think we're learning things about how love is supposed to be structured, that women can't have power. And if they do, that power has to be mediated or controlled. I sometimes get teased and pushed by my students about my thoughts about something like Frozen, which I think is probably it's an amazing visual spectacle. It is a horrible message about women, which a lot of people love it. They're like, oh, they're so strong. The sisters get together at the end. It's horrible. The sister, she is ostracized from her other sister. The two sisters are separated all time. The oldest one will be queen. Elsa, she has powers that she is told that are dangerous, that she has to sort of suppress or hide from. There's not really, gender is one of the major investments of Disney that never seems to go away. And it's always tied to money. We're taught that in order to have love and success, it's tied to some sort of economic advantage, and that women acquiesce. I think those are the two largest, most dangerous, problematic set of messages we get from Disney.
Wow. So how do you handle when your kids want to go or want to see the films? Do you have dialogue? What's the best way to mediate or moderate?
I take them to everything. I believe in having cultural literacy. I believe if we're going to go to a museum, then we should go see a Disney film, that we should play video games, that we should understand how culture works. Part of it's ingrained. I'm a skeptic. I have no problem saying what I need to say, but I also appreciate the pleasure in these things. I think one, folks who dislike Disney, and I dislike much about Disney, want to deny the pleasure aspect, and you have to embrace it to truly be able to interrogate it. But I think that one thing you should take away from Disney is having a real conversation about identity politics and what it means to be a girl and how this is a fiction and how it also shapes how you think of yourself. To be honest with yourself and with your children and other people about the kind of impact it's had on you. Honesty goes a long way.
Mm-hmm. So again, it's art. I think Disney, I read that Disney really thought of it not as cartoons, because back in the day, that's what was coming out, but he thought of what he was doing, animation, as art. So once again, I think art is a focal point to discuss, but I think, as you said before, we don't even realize it's so pervasive. We don't even realize what we're thinking when we're watching it, or, you know, many of us don't. So.
Right. And the artistry is something that we are now blind to. I mean, there's some beautiful films that Disney made in the early years. When he's pulling an artist such as the Spanish surrealist painter Salvador Dali, who does a sequence in Dumbo, where he hired artists to come in and work with his animators. That it gets lost later. But I think the company now is... it has a beautiful resonance to it. One of the reasons why we get so much pleasure from, say, the more recent Disney films is because they look so good. I mean, they're luscious. That is an attention to the ways in which the visual artistry creates desire and creates, you know, crafts attention and makes one want to engage.
Mm-hmm. When you were in making the PBS documentary on him, I read that you got one of the few people to see the Disney archive, whatever that looks like. And I was just wondering, did you uncover or anything there that you were surprised to see, or that, you know, you didn't even know existed?
Well, actually, I did not get to see the archive. But I got to talk with folks who got to see the archive.
And
it might have been a misprint somewhere, but I got to speak with folks who did. No, and that's the ongoing question. What is in the archive? Because they control their brand so carefully.
Right.
They will only roll out or offer particular material that fits with the credo and the spirit of Disney, which is problematic in a variety of ways because you're getting a crafted truth.
Right. But
I know with that documentary, the director, Sarah Colt, she was very much committed to having no input from the Disney Corporation when she made that documentary. And so we all worked very independently as contributors to it. So we got to say whatever we want, which we loved.
And as we're wrapping up, where did your interest in Disney and Hollywood come from?
I think it actually came out of my interest in art. Reginald Marsh was an artist who very much involved in Hollywood. He liked going. He believed in the value of popular culture as a visual resource. And from there, I had studied some film in my undergraduate years, and it seemed to come together nicely. I was also a very interesting student as an undergraduate in the Middle West. And I took a Disney class with an esteemed scholar, and I did not do so well. And I blew off the class. Mm-hmm. And I always promised, I ever made something of myself, I would offer a kind of class like this. And I'm glad I do. I'm glad I study it, because I'm finding it's harder to talk about with people than religion. Uh-huh. It really is.
Yeah, I can see that because it is, like you said, it's the middle class or upper middle class dream of achievement that you've achieved something, or just, you know, that's the thing that you do. Mm-hmm. And that it does seem to be, when I think about those people and my relationships with them, you know, to question it would be really difficult conversation.
Very much
I would
so.
Be an out, you know, I would be outcast and
yep.
all that.
Very much.
Yeah. Nancy, do you see that? I'm questioning
yeah.
you now. I'm interviewing you.
Well, it's, you know, I'd like to think that art wasn't so stressful, I guess.
Well, I guess I mean Disneyland.
As yeah. like politics, but, you know, that's just me. And I know, obviously, from the beginning of this conversation that I am, you know, that not necessarily how others see art. I am well aware of that. I was just wondering, Carmenita, before you leave the show, I was wondering, do you have a favorite artist or four? Or, you know, do you have any favorites?
In the entire history of art or in American art? Or
let's go American, since you are a professor of American art that we brought you on as for American art.
Oh, artists that I'd love to look at.
Yes.
So I'd love to look at, this is going to sound so odd, a colonial artist named Gilbert Stuart. He has a wonderful piece at the National Gallery called The Skater. And I think it's one of the most luscious, wonderful sort of representations of just a gentleman on a single skate. He sits 1 foot up behind him, and the brush stroke, the attention to the body, just it always takes my breath away. I'm a big fan of George Bellows, an artist who worked in the early 20th century. He has a series of boxing pictures that he produced. He's part of the Ashcan group, a set of New York artists that include Robert Henri and John Sloan. But Bellows' work in that group is, it's just so dynamic, and he really gets into the nitty-gritty of the city. He'll take on topics and represent bodies that you can feel them. They're just visceral. They just jump right off the canvas. And those I find to be exquisite. And then I'm a huge Winslow Homer fan. I love his pieces. He's an American artist that worked in everything 1860s and 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s, started off in print culture, making prints for Harper's Weekly, which was a middle class publication, moved on into paintings. And they just take your breath away. They're smaller, intimate sort of scenes. But there are just, I stop every time I see them. Oh, and Ryder. There's a gentleman named Pinkham Ryder. See, you can't do this to art historians.
Oh, no, my goodness.
Okay. Anyway.
Well, I was just going to say, I can see why there's a long waiting list to get into your classes, which I've read about. And I read a really interesting anecdote that people have tried, when they're on the waiting list, they want to get in. They've done some interesting things. Can you give one example?
They come to my office. They'll sing. They'll sing Disney tunes. So I will let them in. That's always very startling. Sometimes they'll follow me around a little bit. That's interesting as well. They'll keep coming to class even if they're not registered and have no hopes of getting into the course, just for the simple fact, just to be there around Disney. It's my teaching.
Do you tell them to wish upon a star? And
oh my goodness!
Get in
or... No, I'm not that good. I'm not that witty.
Well, thank you so much for being here,
yeah,
Dr. Carmenita Higginbotham. I'm professor of American art at the University of Virginia. And thank you, Lori Jean, so much, who works closely with the community and adolescents to end sexual violence. Very important work. Thank you so much, Lori Jean. She can't say thank you because she's not near the microphone, but she's here. She says thank you. We really appreciate both of you being here. We learned a lot.
Thank you.
Ellen, I can see we have a minute or so for a palate cleanser.
For you, I'm going to say 30 seconds. No, a minute.
I can go. I'm going to go fast. I'm not going to.
Okay.
I wanted to give a grand shout out to France for voting for Macron.
Oh, yes. Vive la France.
On Sunday.
Oui, oui.
And delaying the end of the world for, a few spins. I don't know. Thank you.
You're so right about that. I don't even want to say anything.
Right?
I don't have a palate. That is really, I was on, you know, bated breath. Waiting. That's the wrong expression, but you know what I mean. I had the radio tuned as I was traveling back from Knoxville. Really interesting town.
Yes, no more Jerry Lewis jokes, right? We'll give them Sunday. We'll give them a big thank you for Sunday's vote.
Yes, and so what I want to say, remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something during these times. And again, a shout out to the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Thanks for your support. Nance?
Yeah, tell everyone.
See you next week.
Hey, I will.
Oh, go.
Everyone follow us on Twitter at AOS Radio.
Thanks.
There.
Bye, Nance.
I'm doing something.